So today we thought we would talk a little bit more about storage of vegetables and bulbs and a little more on composting, hot and cold composting, and briefly the differences between them, and a little bit on the structures for compost systems. And then as time permits, and we always run out of time, some of the topics that are important for this time of year, like bringing in herbs for the winter, growing greens through the winter, planting bulbs in pots. So we'll see how we go with that. So storage, Michelle, do you have anything to add to what we've talked about before?
Well, I was listening to the podcast of the last shows, and one of the things that I didn't hear was talking about storing your green tomatoes. If you're like me, I just brought my last of my tomatoes in not too long ago from the greenhouse, and there were several green ones. So rather than just leaving them out to all of a sudden have a whole bunch ready at once, I wrap them each and put them in a cardboard box, and I stick them in a cool place. And they ripen a lot more slowly that way, and I just have to remember to go check them.
Check them once in a while. Yes. Are those big tomatoes or are they cherries?
Well, my big tomatoes are maybe 2 to 3 inch size. Yeah. And some cherries too. Yeah. I don't wrap them those individually. They just kind of rattle around in the box.
Yeah. I just lay mine out in a tray in the garage, and right where I walk by it when I get out of the car, and I can see what's getting ripe each day.
But that would work.
Yeah, but either of those methods will work. Another thought we might share with you on bulbs like begonias and that sort of thing is to, if you're going to take them out of the pot, to get a liquor box that has the dividers in it. Fill it half full with peat moss, put one bulb in each of the cells that is there, and then cover it the rest of the way with peat moss. That way, if one of the bulbs rots, it doesn't spread rot to the other bulbs.
And you also know where exactly to look for those bulbs.
Right. Label the box. Yeah, and then put it someplace where it won't freeze. I did that for a number of years, and then Charlotte Jewell in Skagway pointed out to me that what she does with her begonias is she just lets them dry out and then puts them someplace where they won't freeze. So the last few years I've done that, and I just let the tops all die down, and then I put them in an unheated shop that stays above freezing, put the pots on a sheet of styrofoam so that it's not directly on the cement, because I've had bulbs freeze if it was directly on the cement.
Sure.
But that just gives enough layer of insulation. So anyway, if you have any other storage tips, you can email them to us at garden@khns.org, because we are always looking for ideas there. So we want to talk also a little bit more about composting. We covered that 2 weeks ago, and that was recorded, by the way, so we were glad to hear that. Hot and cold composting. Most of us here do cold composting. It requires a temperature of about 55 degrees or above. And with the cold composting, you can add materials continually to your compost bin anytime that you want to. The alternative is hot composting. In that case, the pile has to all be built at once, and you want to keep a temperature of 130 degrees for a few days. The problem is that at 130 degrees, you kill all your earthworms. They'll tend to leave as it's warming up, but any that are still there, you're going to be cooking them. I had a friend in Central California who tried a hot composting system on the theory that if some is good, more is better. She built her pile on the southwest corner of her barn and filled it full of wet straw and fresh manure, and it went above 130, caught fire, and burned down her barn. Maybe
yeah,
not
a,
Right. That's how a lot of barns have burned.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. When you hear these barn fires, that's what it is.
I thought she had a unique experience, but maybe not. So anyway, most of us here really just do the cold composting. But if you want to look at the pros and cons on that and get a little more information, Stu Campbell's book, Let It Rot, will give you some really good ideas, as will the Rodale Institute's books on composting. And there's quite a few books in the library that you can take a look at. In terms of structures for compost bins, this year I changed over to the Menneker design. We talked about it briefly a couple weeks ago. I got it actually from Betsy, who got it from Menneker's, who got it from Rodale Institute. We gardeners share ideas. We really like doing that. Anyway, this one is really easy to do. You get about 30 2x2s that are 8 feet long and cut them in half, so they're 4 feet long, and then just stack them up like Lincoln logs. So if you would just right now place your index fingers at right angles over one another, you can see basically how those things build up. Mm-hmm. And then you can build it up to 4 feet high and just keep building it, you know, until you reach that 4 foot level. It's probably a good idea here to cover it with plastic or some kind of a lid to keep the rain out. I use Polygal, which is that clear siding you use on greenhouses.
Oh, sure.
And that helps heat it up and keeps the rain from getting in. But Polygal is a little pricey.
I've found that I've got a couple of different composting systems going, but one of them where I throw all my weeds from the garden before I use them in non-garden places. Is one of those prefab recycled plastic bins with a plastic lid on it. And I found it gets quite dry in there. Mm-hmm. And I actually have to open it up when it rains. So I don't know if it's the size or the or what, but I find that leaving the lid on all the time, it just dries out and just sits there.
And it has holes punched in it for ventilation?
Towards the bottom. Okay. But not at the top.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I just built another recycle bin out of, what do you call those things?
Pallets.
Crates. Pallets. Yeah. Yeah, I just wired them all together and filled it up.
Yeah.
One on the bottom, too.
A lot of people do that with the pallets.
It's easy. There's all kind of air getting into it.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. And you can do it with just wire screen, that pig wire or any kind of a wire. Either in a square or in a circle. Another one that I've found that works really well are old washing machine tubs. They have all the holes in them, and I have one down by my greenhouse, and they're open to the bottom so the earthworms can get in there. They drain nicely.
Mm-hmm.
And good way to use up an old washing machine tub. If you are interested in obtaining some of those, call the recycling center at 766-3000.
We'll
get you in touch with one of them. Other composting systems might be just digging a trench and putting the scraps in them. Michelle, if you have fish or anything like that, what do you do with that, with your compost bin?
Well, I have put it in the pile, but I'd need to bury it pretty deep. And I actually, in our open bins that are the Lincoln log style, I have a mesh over the top to keep the ravens out, because they've figured it out.
They're smart.
Yeah.
They will watch us, yeah. So you dig a hole and then
dig
bury the fish
down. Dig a hole
and
bury it deep, yeah. Or put it right in the side of the bucket when I was growing in buckets in the greenhouse. You could put it down in there.
Huh.
Into the...
Oh, okay.
Directly into the side of the pot.
Huh. And doesn't smell too bad?
Well.
We're gardeners.
It's a garden. Yes.
Organic gardeners. We're kind of used to these. Bad smell is a relative concept. Yeah. Okay. You can also, if you're building a new raised bed, you can, once you put the cardboard down, you can put all kinds of food scraps and garden scraps and so on in the bottom. Especially for the first year, as that's breaking down biochemically, that will tend to warm up the bed, and so that works out really well.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, on to our next topic, which is keeping records and mapping and setting goals for 2017, which is around the corner. Yeah. Michelle, what is it that you do?
Well, last night as I was getting ready for this morning, I was looking at my records from 2016 and getting kind of stuff set up for 2017. I have a spreadsheet on my computer. I keep track of the dates because it's so many different parts to remember, and I can't remember it all if it's not all written down.
Uh-huh.
And so I keep a log of the planting dates, the varieties that I put in, and I try to put some notes at the end of the season about like how good the harvest was on this or that variety and stuff. And sometimes it's just a photograph or two of what came out of the garden is what my notes are, rather than actual.
I can see where that's a really good idea, but that's like me trying to keep a diary or a journal. It just doesn't happen.
Yeah, but it works really nicely. One of the things that I like about it is that it keeps me thinking about the garden through the winter. And you know, I do a lot of research for the garden in the winter. And one of the things I came across a few years ago was a quote from a fellow named Liberty Hyde Bailey. He was a horticulturist, botanist, and co-founder of the American Society for Horticultural Science, so turn of the last century. And he said, "A garden is half made when it's well planned. The best gardener is the one that does the most gardening by the winter fire." So so I do a lot of that, and I really liked that quote because it felt familiar,
right?
And I also read an article online somewhere years ago about setting a garden mission statement, which is part of the planning process for all kinds of things, is setting a mission statement. And it's like I couldn't figure out why at first, and then I thought about it. Well, of course, you know, if I do this, then I might have an idea of what exactly it is I'm trying to do here. And keeps me from buying every seed I want to try, you know, and keeping to my plan. And so, let's see, in my mission statement, didn't get written down in here. And I don't have it memorized. I'll estimate it here. My organic garden is. Can't do it.
Yeah. Well, anyway, it's beautiful.
I'll bring it back. I'll bring it back to you
next time she's on the air. Yeah, because it's a beautiful idea. And I keep a monthly calendar of what I need to do. So that, you know, it says in January to go to a tropical island and you know, check out their gardens there. But it's I just keep that monthly calendar really helps me. And then I keep notes on what kind of veggies and flowers, varieties, planting dates, and then general notes. And I try to experiment with a few new varieties each year and set the goals now as we're moving inside. It's a good time to start writing all of this down while we can still remember it, because in the winter it's hard to realize we have summers, and in the summer it's hard to realize we have winters. So another time we will talk about bringing in herbs, growing greens through the winter, and planting bulbs in pots.
You know, okay, I would like to know how much you have to grow to put away so that you can have vegetables all year round. That would be an interesting topic, I think.
Yeah, and that's
per family or per person.
Yeah, and I think that's a really good question. I don't know if it's possible to really quantify it, other than if you run out, then next year plant more, and if you don't have it, you know, you have too much, plant less.
Plant less. Okay.
Share if you have too much.
There you go. All right, so if people want to have questions, just how do they get in touch with you?
garden@khns.org.
garden@khns.org.
And we're looking forward to your questions and comments and ideas. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Michelle and Melissa, with the Garden Talk. Thank you.